Hello and welcome to the Cyber Unions Talk Show. We are building an open source labor movement. I'm Walton in Glasgow, Scotland.
And I'm Stephen, reporting from deep inside corporate-controlled America.
So, we're coming to you today, a day late, in fact, because we have been experimenting with alternatives to Skype, and we spent many, many hours test-driving alternatives last night when we were trying to record this show, and our endeavors weren't entirely successful.
Or daytime if you're in the States.
Sorry, yes, I forgot about the time zone difference. But we spent hours trying to find alternatives, and it was a difficult and frustrating process, wasn't it, Stephen?
Yes, definitely. Though, for listeners who listened to episode 3, that one actually was done on an alternative one instead of Skype. We actually used Jabber or Google Talk. I think we talked about that in the show, which was good, but it had its downfalls and things that we're looking forward to seeing change. The others, do you want to talk a little bit about Ekija?
Well, we tried two, Ekija and Linphone. It seemed to be very, very promising when we installed them and set them up. Everything seemed to work well. Initially, it found the webcam and sound input and all that kind of thing perfectly. There was just a really, really minor detail, which meant that it wasn't ideal. And that is that we were not able to speak to each other. We weren't able to make a connection.
Very true. And if it weren't for our Jabber clients of IMing back and forth, we would never have been able to talk at all. But yeah, and just some background for some people who may never heard of Ekija or Linphone. If you've used Linux before, Ekija used to be the standard install with most Ubuntu Linux distributions up until, I think, about a year or so ago when they started using Empathy instead, which doesn't have the voice over IP functions that we're specifically looking for as of yet. They have Jabber on there, but Jabber has some issues. Linphone actually is an SIP client, which is Simple Internet Protocol, I think Simple Internet Protocol? I can't remember the exact acronym, what that stands for. How about that? I'm going to look that up right now. What trouble did you run into with Ekija, Walton?
It didn't work. I kept trying to call you and it said user not found, and I think that it was a networking issue. I think probably I had a firewall on my router, or you had a firewall on yours, and the communication port wasn't open. It wasn't allowing traffic through, so yeah, we couldn't find each other as users.
Yeah,
and we're not clever enough to figure that stuff out yet, so yeah, we persevere.
It can be a bit of a frustration, and it's not Simple Internet. My apologies for those wonderful listeners who are going to give me crap for that. It's Session Initiation Protocol, which is actually pretty. It's not anything new. It's been around for quite some time, but it Ekija.
I have correct pronunciation.
If you will, Walton.
I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you're right.
With my American accent, I'm sure I'm not right, but that's beside the point. The Linphone was actually a tool that I heard talked about on Linux Outlaws that they were testing out, and I think it's Dan Lynch from Linux Outlaws had tried it out. And he said that it came across pretty easily for him, and it set him up pretty quick. I decided to try that, and again, the install was pretty easy. The only problem was calling each other was not functional for some reason. And it was a little bit frustrating, and again, I think it was the same thing on my end. Even though I have a little bit more technical or network experience, I still could not figure out how to break past the firewall issues that we were running into, I think. Which is odd that Skype is able to. It kind of scares me a little. But what are we going to do? So, what is it that you like about these open source tools that we were trying out here, Walton, even though we haven't gotten them to completely work?
Yeah, we're either really stubborn or we're masochists and suckers for punishment, because why would we put ourselves through the effort of spending hours and hours and hours trying to make an obscure open source tool work when there's a widely available gift from our great benefactor Bill Gates called Skype that we can use to freely speak to each other? And what it comes down to is we have a deep respect for the way these tools are developed. Open source development is produced with openness, transparency, and degrees of democracy. It depends on the project. Some are more democratic than others, but the operating system we're using, Debian, is produced essentially by a worldwide workers' cooperative, and we really respect that way of working, and we'd like to promote it and see more of it. So for us, it's the least we can do to try and get the tools working and to contribute as much as we can to these projects because I think it's important.
It is true, and I think it's a very good point. I think one of the things that always attracted me, and I think we've touched on this topic before, about open source that is kind of cool, is that they are kind of have elements that I long for. And I remember this back to when I was learning like in civics class about what was important to our government in the U.S. at least, is this whole idea of democracy and that it's open and people from all walks of life are treated equally. And unfortunately, I don't really see that in capitalism. So with certain exceptions, I guess you could say, when there's a union and a workshop, there's going to be democracy in that place better than there was before, but it's still not perfect. And in open source, I kind of saw that there's a community, and at first I was scared of it, but then I started seeing that there are people coming from all different walks of life that were approaching these communities and contributing, and you could actually see what was talked about, where the ideas were coming from, the credit was given to people who brought up the ideas, the things were very transparent, there was a process to making decisions, they basically has all the elements of democracy, and sometimes democracy can be run incorrectly and not run well, but they're there, and it just intrigued me ideologically, and it intrigued me because I could download this and say that I'm a part of that community by contributing, giving ideas, whether it's a bug report or saying, hey, this is something that would be really cool to see happen, or if you have the technical skills to actually do the programming and putting the software together. That's something that we should all be seeking towards practicing.
Yeah, and for me, open source is such an inspiring model that, you know, I began to wonder if it can only exist in cyberspace, which is this post-scarcity environment where you can create things just by clicking a button and it doesn't use up any finite resources. And, you know, a bit of research shows that the idea of cooperating is not actually new. And so we had a conversation earlier, and we were able to find links between the way open source software is developed and the cooperative movement, which has been around for quite a long time and which trade unions have been involved in to a greater or lesser extent for a while. What are your thoughts on co-ops, Stephen?
That's a brilliant segue, by the way, going into our next topic with co-ops. One of the things that when I was a graduate student, I actually had the chance to study some of this stuff, and that's why it's intriguing to me. Don't mind the helicopters in the outside background. I do live in a military state, if you can hear it.
Is that you there after, Stephen?
But apparently, maybe. I live right near the airport, too, which doesn't help. So, but it very well could be a military helicopter. I've seen them fly by. Anyway, back to what we're hoping for is a better world. There's the United Steelworkers, which is a union in the States that used to be very, very strong, and they still are still a large union in this country, but they also tend to be a little bit more progressive and to the left of the mainstream labor movement. Their leader actually is one that is farther left than leaders of other unions in the States. They have two different interesting agreements, one that directly connects to you, Walton, and one that connects to what we're going after, which is their agreement that they signed a couple years ago with an organization called Mondragon, or a cooperative called Mondragon, which is a Basque country-based company. For those who don't know what the Basque country is, it's a region of Spain that has some autonomy, as many regions of Spain do, from the national government. And the Mondragon was developed as more of a post-world, I think it's mostly post-World War II, if I remember correctly, development. And the reason that it comes across as interesting to me is I learned it in a course that was studying comparative socialist economies. And the course mostly talked about former communist countries or socialist countries, if you will, and what their economies looked like and how they functioned and how worker contribution was done, if there was any, what the democracy looked like. And Mondragon kind of encompassed it all within a company of worker control, cooperative connections to the communities, and involvement. And it's a very intriguing concept because Mondragon is a global cooperative that has manufacturing plants all over the world. It's a model that they've decided to work with the United Steelworkers on trying to replicate these developments of co-ops in the States, as our manufacturing industry in this country has gone down over the last 40-odd years due to neoliberal economic policies and capitalist policies in and of themselves. What's intriguing, though, is it's kind of really a material way of looking at the abstract cooperative, so to speak, that we see in software development.
Absolutely, yeah. What do they make, Mondragon? What sort of range of products do they make?
They're mostly known for bicycles, mountain bikes, racing bikes, and these are not inexpensive by any stretch. If you ever go to look up their costs, they're roughly about $5,000 US, which so they're not exactly cheap, but they are very well known. They're very well developed, so they are very big globally. They have a lot, and they have a perspective of this economy that we're in, capitalist economy that we're in, isn't working. It's not working the way it should be working by any stretch of the idea of the free markets ever working, but their model is something that is working. They have been able to, you know, prevent corporate control from taking over their company because the workers have a voice. Everybody has one vote as a worker collective. And though some of their operations in different parts of the country, all the workers are not all part of the collective, but that's something that they have actually are working on, or cooperative for that matter. And I do want to make a distinction on that. There's collectives, worker-run collectives, and worker-run cooperatives, and there is a difference between the two, which we'll go into a little bit in more detail. What is the perspective, I guess, from your point of view, Walton, on co-ops?
There is a big cooperative tradition in the UK. There's a co-op bank and a co-op supermarket and a number of co-op organizations. And also, there's also a very big department store called John Lewis Stores, which is a cooperative partnership. It's still capitalism, but it's a preferable model of capitalism because there is genuine partnership with the people working there. And the crucial difference is that a cooperative business tends not to be short-termist because it's not trying to maximize profit for a group of shareholders who might disappear at any moment, but they're actually investing long term in the business. And it's quite interesting to see that a high street chain like John Lewis is actually very, very successful precisely because they invest long term in building up the business. And in the UK, another example is Suma Whole Foods, which anyone who goes to a health shop will have seen their products. They're a much smaller organization than John Lewis, but it's also that is a worker run collective. For me, the best collectives and co-ops really create a kind of autonomous zone in neoliberal capitalist sea. They're islands of relative sanity and places where we can build and gather a bit of strength. And I'd really like to see more of them. We've been unable to change the entire system, but if we can create islands of good practice, islands of economics which is practiced democratically and fairly, and with respect both for people and for the planet, link up these enterprises into a global network, I think we've got something quite powerful to work on. So I very much see open source software as being part of that cooperative movement, and I'd like to see those links made a lot more explicitly. Links between open source software, the co-op movement, and trade unions, I'd like to see them all realizing that they're part of a much wider movement to democratize work, make it fairer, to resolve some of the alienation of labor by giving people back the products of their work and giving them a say in how their work is structured. Because after all, most of us spend most of our lives working, and very few of us get any say over how our working day is structured. And the more we can democratize the workplace, the more we democratize life. It's one of the most important elements of our life, and yet we tend to mostly live in economic dictatorships where we have very little say. So I'm very supportive of co-ops, and I'd like to see them develop and advance.
And I think it's a great point. And I think one of the things that I like about co-ops, and it's a lot like capitalism, you know, a lot of people have this hesitancy. They don't want to do something because they're waiting for some answer to come from above. And with the labor movements and co-ops, you as a member, you as an activist within the social movements can't wait for the union to make that decision. You as an active member needs to push and bring people together, either developing your own or pushing the union itself to say, hey, this is something we need to be adopting. Whether it's something simple like supporting a local food co-op, just for distinction purposes, Suma Whole Foods, for those in the States, is not Whole Foods, the food grocery store in the States, which is very anti-union, completely different perspective, and a corporation. Just wanted to make that side note. the point being is that there are a lot of simple things that a lot of local unions can automatically pick up without even changing what they currently have set up. Now, Walton and I both advocate for use of tools that are not Microsoft, not Apple. But the point being is that we know that a lot of unions use Microsoft. We know that a lot of social groups and organizations use OS X or MacBooks. So what we want to do is talk about things that are going to be supporting things that are like cooperatives and open source type of communities in those areas. It's something that Walton and I are trying to do with our own with this show here, of trying to develop a collective. Walton and I are two individual people that are across the sea, but we've come together to develop this podcast, and we want to make sure that we maintain this experiment that we're in as a collective, that neither of us is going to take over control, that we're going to put things to a consensus as we bring in more people to develop this. In that same stretch, and I know it's a stretch to go from that to using these tools. I know my previous union had Windows on all their computers. They also had Microsoft Word on all their computers, and they all had Internet Explorer. I don't know about you, Walton. Is that something common in the UK,
too? It's common in the UK. Most unions have Windows XP, Microsoft Word, and Internet Explorer 6, which is probably the worst possible thing you could have on your computer for
browsing. Ouch, 6?
6.
Wow, that's
so
old.
Yeah, so I think one of the things we realize when doing this show is that we talk a lot about Linux and how wonderful open source tools are, but we also realize a lot of people are in environments where they don't really have the freedom to change their operating system, because even if Linux is a wonderful thing, the logistics behind installing it on the entire union system and changing the membership database system and upgrading everything and changing it to Linux is actually quite big. So we thought it would be useful to look at some quite simple free open source tools that you can run on Windows or on Mac to save yourself or the union money, and also to try open source and get a feel for how the tools work before you make a bigger commitment. So, Stephen, what should we start with? What's the most practical first tool for people to use?
I think when it comes to the internet and use, I think the first thing that people are going to jump to is going to be how they're viewing the internet and what they're using. If you go with Windows, you're going to have Internet Explorer default installed, and Internet Explorer is highly proprietary. It's highly controlled by Microsoft, and you don't have any ability to look at how that was developed or know what the community is like about developing that. And one of the tools that many people have probably have heard about and may have used at some point is Firefox, or coming originally as the form of Netscape way back when there was the internet browser wars of the, was it late 90s?
Late 90s.
And that was the last time we saw, Firefox is still around, and Firefox is even better. I'm using Firefox 4 currently, and it's phenomenal. And there's a bit of an open source competition. There's Firefox, and there's also Chrome, or Chromium is the true open source version of Chrome, which is developed by Google, and the communities around that too. And those are just two simple things that you can install into your computer, and you know that there's going to be more security with it than there is with Internet Explorer, because Internet Explorer is plagued with security issues. And I'm not trying to lambast the work that goes into that, but it's just a matter that they're not open enough to allow other people that are saying, hey, this might be a problem that you need to look into. They don't have that same open functionality because they're run by a profiteering company. And whereas Firefox is not.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point to make, is that it's in Microsoft's interest to hide problems from you, because the problems can cost it money. And also to spend as little as possible in solving problems, because they want to ship a product as cheaply as they can get away with. That incentive doesn't exist with open source development, and it's generally a principle that bugs are not hidden. So if there's a problem, they explicitly say what the problem is and say, we're working on it, you can help to work on it. If you come across a problem that we're not aware of, please tell us and we will work on it. And the cumulative effects of having tens and sometimes hundreds of thousands of people experimenting with the software, using it and feeding back, means that bugs get reported really, really quickly, and usually they can be fixed quickly. So you get much higher security levels on something like Firefox.
That's very true. And also for those that are using OS X, Safari browser for that matter, Firefox works on that system as well. It works on Linux, it works on Windows, it works on all devices. And even those that have Android cell phones can install their mobile version of Firefox on there. Or if you have the one and only MAMO devices out there, you can also install Firefox on there too. But But I think that's one of the simplest things to actually change. It's not hard. It's installing it. The functionalities are all there. Firefox, I think, has a larger and greater respect within the world than Internet Explorer does. Chrome has been growing over the years, and it's more of a open source competition between the two, and they actually openly share things. So you'll see functionality that's on Chrome that Firefox has, and you'll see functionality between them sharing ideas and picking up different ideas. And it's not a matter of saying, hey, this is proprietary, this is mine. That's inefficient. If you do that, we're going to have inefficiencies, which is the problem with part of the economies, is it's exceptionally inefficient. One of the similar tools that, if you don't mind me going on here, Walton, is called OpenOffice, or as some in the open source communities will know, is LibreOffice. And that is to replace your Microsoft Office that has Word, Excel, PowerPoint presentation. And it's a very well-developed community, and it is such a simplistic change. And one of the best things, I think, and this is something I'd love to see labor unions take on, is instead of sending their proposals to their corporate heads with a .doc file, I'd love to see them send it with a .odf, and which is open source, open document format. Yeah, open document format. And you know what? Force your bosses to use open source, because that's one way of doing it. I'm sorry, did you not get our proposals? Then you might have to download this, because you've been telling us how to do our lives. We're going to start telling you how to do yours, which I think would just be a nice little gist to them. Mm-hmm. But the point being, though, with open source, OpenOffice for that matter, is you can save it as a Word document if you need to. Mm-hmm. You can save it as different formats if you need to.
For me, that's the thing. I'm using LibreOffice, and there's a very slight difference between the two. It's essentially the same project, which for, I suppose you could say, political reasons, went in two separate directions.
They have been brought back together, by the way.
Oh, have they? I didn't even realize that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oracle did give up the development back to LibreOffice. So OpenOffice, now the term OpenOffice, that's still in question whether Oracle's actually going to claim copyright on it. But the community has opened back, and they gave it back to LibreOffice. So the community will come back together.
LibreOffice, OpenOffice, it's a open source office package, and the great thing about it, as Stephen says, is the formats. If you have an old version of Microsoft Word, you can't even open a .docx file on it without installing a patch from the internet or something like that. OpenOffice can open just about anything. It can open any form of document, and it can generally save in any form of document as well. It can also export to PDF, which I find really, really useful if you need to create a PDF document or a document which can't easily be edited by someone else. You can just export an OpenOffice document to PDF, which is really handy. And it also does interact quite well with Microsoft Word. So I've used it extensively where proofread copy for people, and I've written in track changes in OpenOffice and saved it as a Word document, sent it back, and the changes come across perfectly when they opened it in Microsoft Word. So it's a very effective product. It's free. It will save you a lot of money if you use that instead of Microsoft Word.
And I think that's the key thing. I mean, we talk about freedom, and there's freedom as in free, as in like free beer, and then there's actual freedom about, you know, freedom of speech. And I think that's the key thing here with LibreOffice is it's both. You can actually download it for free. There are, you know, other organizations that sponsor the development. Google is one of them. But there are other corporations that are involved because they see the success of this model of developing is better. It's going to be stronger down the road. And it's not a matter of, like, giving away trade secrets. That's not the point. It's a matter that we're trying to develop something better, and this is one way of doing it. And Libre/OpenOffice, I think, is a simple tool. You can download it from their website. It's the Document Foundation is the organization that runs it, and we will definitely provide a link in the show notes both to Firefox and LibreOffice for you to take a look at, because it's easy. It's not going to cost you anything. And if you had an old version of Microsoft Suite or Office or whatever, and you tried to open up a new document, you had to buy it to be able to download it to look at it. And that's ridiculous. It's inefficient. That's not what free market of any sort is going to be. It's going to be, you know, something that's easily updatable and changes very quickly. And I think that's the beauty of it. And I think that's why, you know, we encourage members to use it. And we want members of unions and social movements as well to push their organization and their leaders within there to use it as well.
There's three other tools I'd like to mention just briefly. And these are a little bit more specialist. But if you ever have to produce union publications like newsletters, they're ideal. The tools are Scribus, Inkscape, and GIMP. That's GNOME Image Manipulation Program, I believe it stands for. We'll put links into the show notes about those as well. And I have some background in journalism, and I've been trained to use Quark Express and Adobe InDesign, which are the two industry standard desktop publishing packages, and they're very, very good programs, and they produce wonderful documents. They're also extremely expensive. And Scribus is an open source alternative to InDesign. To be honest, not quite as user friendly, but it's free and it's open source and it works pretty well. And it works on the same principles. Now, if you've never used desktop publishing before and you download Scribus, there'll be a bit of a learning curve. Don't get too frustrated with that. You can read the manuals and teach yourself, but it does produce high quality newsletters. It works on the same kind of layering system that most design software works on, and it's highly effective. And you use it in conjunction with GIMP, which is really a Photoshop replacement, and does the same kind of thing as Photoshop, except that it's a free and open source software tool. And so GIMP and Scribus together, you can do a really good job of manipulating images and laying them out in a union newsletter. The final one is Inkscape. That is a vector graphics producer. So if you need to create a logo or an image or a badge for an organization or for a campaign or to illustrate a website, you could use Inkscape instead of a similar proprietary product. And took me a while to learn Inkscape, but there are video tutorials online on places like YouTube, and there's a lot of documentation. If you prepare to take the time to read the documentation, you can produce high quality vector graphics using Inkscape. So well worth exploring those tools. They're free. Maybe you're a designer and you've been asking someone to buy you a license for Photoshop for some time and they've refused because there's no business case. You don't need the business case anymore. Just install the free software and teach yourself GIMP and Inkscape, and there's a lot of creative stuff you can do with that.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, there are other tools that we will also talk about, tools that we use to produce this show, Audacity, which you've mentioned last week. There's another tool that I use, which is called OpenShot, which does video editing, which is really good if you're going to create a YouTube video. And it's very, all of these are open source, and they're simple replacements. You can install it on your Linux operating system, but you can also install them onto Windows and OS X. So they're great tools, and I think a lot of those communities, and I'd give them a lot of feedback whenever I see some bugs that are coming up that are affecting me. Of course, it's not a matter of just filing the bug; it's researching to find out if that bug has been reported first too. They're really helpful things, and I think it's just something simple that local unions can start making use of, and members can start pushing them to use it, because otherwise they're paying for something; they're putting dues money towards Microsoft, they're putting dues money towards Apple, they're putting dues money towards some other corporation that doesn't really respect worker rights, does not care for unions, and doesn't have any interest in making sure that happens. So that's why we encourage the use of these tools, and we hope that everybody else starts using them. And don't be afraid to jump into the communities to be a part of them. Feedback that they get is really good, and it's feedback that, you know, is helpful for making their products better. And I don't think I could build a better segue into the next topic here, Walton, than saying that.
Yes, you're just talking about the importance of feedback, and we have been broadcasting our podcast for several episodes now, not knowing if anyone's listening and what you think of it. And some feedback has started to come back, and it's been really, really useful to us. So firstly, thank you to everyone who has listened to the show, and especially thank you to those who've given us feedback. Mark of Radio Labor wrote to us and gave us some very good ideas, which we'll definitely take on board. We also had good feedback from Keir, from Liberty and Solidarity, who he gave us some feedback on open source social networks, alternatives to Facebook, and he mentioned the Appleseed project, which we hadn't looked into. So thanks, Keir. We'll investigate Appleseed, and we'll see how we get on with that. And who else have we had feedback from?
Well, Jamie, I believe, is his first name, but he's known as ReachMe. That's ReechMe on Identica is where I know him. I think he's also on Twitter. We apparently got him over to Identica just by our first show, which is great to see. But his feedback was actually about Apple. In our previous show, we had talked about Microsoft being very anti-union, and Apple is definitely in the same boat. Mostly, the most relevant ones that people are aware of is actually Foxconn, which are the producers of the Apple iPhone, where the conditions of the work are so bad there that people have chosen to take their life instead of continuing working there. And that just shows that, you know, these high-tech technology things that we're using every day, there's a tremendous amount of physical labor that goes into producing it. And it's not just the physical labor, but it's the conditions within that physical labor. The chemicals that they're using, the measures of how many people are going in there and how much they're being asked to produce in such a shorter period of time. As everybody knows, the iPhone comes out, what, once a year? Guess when the time period is on they're doing mass production. It's building up to that time. And these workers are going through very harsh conditions. And Apple doesn't see the light. They don't see the need to actually allow, one, the Foxconn to let their workers organize. But they keep causing a harsher condition. And if you ever look at your Mac products in the States, I know for sure, I don't know about in any other part of the world, but if you look on the back, it always says designed in California, but it's not manufactured in California. So they don't have the same labor rights that we deal with here. Not that they're fully implemented in the States either, but that's beside the point. But I just wanted to thank him for pointing that out, and I told him we'd talk a little bit more about it. So we do encourage a lot of these ideas to come back to us. We've gotten some others as well, Walton, and want to add more.
Yeah, I've also got a comment from John, who's a new media officer at the TUC, so clearly an expert in the field. So we're really happy to hear from him as well. He gave us a lot of really important and interesting advice. So very important to us that we keep getting feedback from you, because we want the podcast to be as useful as possible. Stephen and I share a similar interest, so there's the danger that we could go off on some mad discursive tangent talking about some highly, highly niche end of the open source and labor movement spectrum, which is interesting only to the two of us. And we need you to pull us back from that if that is what's happening, and tell us what it is that you really need to hear, what you need us to go and experiment with and report back on. So please keep ideas and suggestions coming in, and we'll do our best to incorporate them.
Well, thank you, Walton. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about today?
No, I think that's it.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us for another podcast of the Cyber Unions Talk Show, and look forward to hearing in future episodes.